So, my beloved is not here this morning, but if she were here, she would tell you that one of the routines that she returns to on a fairly regular basis is wandering around the house, muttering to herself, "I'm going to throw everything away." Oh, you laugh. Because you recognize this, don't you? All of those things that we have accumulated in our lives that have meant so much to us and that will give us a sense of purpose and meaning. Now, I'm talking about everything other than books, right? Because if I talk about books, I'm going to start to have to deal with my own internal struggle. We've reached that stage in our relationship where I have to sneak them into the house under the cover of darkness and claim that they've always been there and that somehow she just didn't notice those things. And for those of you who have been taking seriously this notion that we live in these environments surrounded by stuff, right? Wasn't it George Carlin that said, "It's crap to everyone else, but stuff to you"? He may have used another term, but I shall not indulge, right? And Robin, who has to daily live with the sight of my office compared to hers, you know, sidles up one day and says, "You ought to read this book, The Swedish Art of Death Cleaning," which I'm going to assign to my students in the sociology of death and dying just as an option for them to consider reading and understanding. And there is another wonderful one that's out about Japanese cleaning. Who's read it? What is it? Marie Kondo. What's The Art of Tidying Up. So there are a couple of things in both of these books that have sort of melded together in my head, and I'm not certain which book it is, but they speak to this tendency for us to go through these routines where it's either throw it all away or keep it all. And we get stuck in that experience of consumerist catatonia, right? Where we don't even know where to begin, right? We don't even know, you know, we know we need to clean it up, but we're not certain what to do with it once we've done that. And ultimately, this is what happens. We clean it up by putting it in a box. And then we put the box either in the basement or the back room. Now, we've lived in the same house for 20 years, right? There are rooms in my house with 15 boxes, right? Of all the stuff we put away. And now we're at the second level of this, which we figure out we need to either put away or throw away the things that we put away to begin with, right? It is an exponential kind of experience, is it not? And I have occasionally run across those boxes of all the stuff that I put away when I wanted to save all the things that when I was a teenager, right? All of those, the little tchotchkes and trophies and things, and now I have teenagers in my house, and I really don't want them to see this box, right? And yet, I don't want to throw it away either. And the question is, why? What is it about me that has a hard time dealing with the things that remind me of my past? So today's conversation with you is about surrender and letting go, and part of what I think we are about doing is learning how to deal with the stuff in our lives. And I'm not just talking about the physical stuff. I'm also talking about the stuff we carry with us. You know what I mean? And we don't really know what to do with it. Because maybe by letting it go, we would have nothing to bitch about, right? And what are we going to do if we can't complain about something? Maybe we would actually thrive in the ways that we assume we can if we would just learn to let go. But letting go is far more challenging than we imagine. And I think Ken's going to delve into some of this about just the things that we carry in our culture that we don't even know are our baggage, right? That are associated with what it means to grow up in this culture and have privilege that you didn't earn and frankly don't deserve. And yet we carry that with us, and we carry it into environments, and we don't even know we're carrying it into environments. But other people see it, other people experience it, and part of what it means is to be conscious of it. So the first order of business is to become conscious of the stuff and why it is that it's so hard to let go. The second thing I think has to do with being able to tend to that stuff in a meaningful way, to acknowledge it in order to be able to release it. I spend a lot of my energy in ministry, in pastoral care settings, talking with people who feel like they are stuck in habits, in ways of being that are inhibiting them from being the full expression of who they understand intuitively they're capable of being, but they can't get there. And one of the most profound experiences in those pastoral moments is the ability for the conversation to turn to some habit, some way of being. If I were going to meddle right now, it would talk about those of us who have the ultimate desire to be compassionate but to control everything. Ooh, I am meddling now. Right? The ultimate desire to be loving but to make certain that whatever happens is the way we want it to happen. And talk about where that particular habit comes from. That orientation toward the way we are with others, and recognize that at some point early on in life, we had an experience where that kind of control saved us emotionally, physically, mentally, spiritually from the environment we were in that could have wounded us deeply. And the only way we could deal with it was to manage it in the way that allowed us to control everything. Anyone recognize this tendency? And at some point in our adult existence, this thing crops up again, especially if we are in long-term relationship with someone who is finally done taking our crap about having to control not only the environment, but them. And either that relationship spins off into, you know, something that it wasn't meant to be, or we get a chance to start to self-reflect about what it is we want to be in the world and how it is we might want to change the way we are in order to be that. The Gospels, the Christian Gospels, tell the wonderful story of a conversation between a rich man and Jesus, where the rich man says to Jesus, what must I do to inherit the kingdom of heaven? And Jesus says, give it all up and follow me. And what's fascinating is there are some scholars that talk about that particular passage in Scripture and say, well, this is really about what it means to take up the nomadic life. This is, you know, you're going to now become a follower of this prophetic divine being, and you've got to give up everything in order to do that. It's kind of the all or nothing, you know, either we throw it all away or we keep it all scenario in Christian spiritualese. But there's another way of framing that particular response, and the way of framing it is that what Jesus says to the rich man is not give it all up, but it's actually the question behind it, which is, how are you going to be defined? Are you going to be defined by what you inherit? By what you have by virtue of the way you came into the world or the way your early environments were shaped? Is that are you going to be defined by your genetic predisposition? By the environment that shaped you originally? Or at some point, do we need to be defined by our capacity to be to make choices, to recognize we have the power to deal with our past and to enter our future. How many of us have been in those positions in our lives where we've had this experience of not wanting to let go of the image we had of ourselves? Right? So in my life, it's always the conversation between my doctor and I. The doctor says, you got to lose weight. Which is a process, is it not? You eat differently, you make different choices, you exercise more. Oh God, you exercise more. And you lose weight. Except that that conversation doesn't take into consideration that I have spent most of my life living as a large, white, gregarious man. And part of the internal conversation is, what does it mean to live as a less large, white, gregarious man? What does it mean to reshape how we feel about ourselves and what motivates us and how we operate in the world? Because with all of these things we struggle with, there's power dynamics. So learning to let go is more than just simply changing a habit. It's also learning to change the way we look at ourselves and each other. What would it be for us to let go of our tendency to think of things as blue and red and black and white? Would it be to enter the gray area of maybe there's something far more complex about this than we're willing to admit and handle? Maybe the family member that is as rabidly conservative as we are rabidly liberal, and you know who you are. Right? Maybe the two of you actually have more in common about your need to be right about the way in which the world operates than either of you are willing to admit. That's a hard thing to have to deal with. And we do this kind of thing all the time, do we not? We put ourselves in these spaces where letting go is extraordinarily difficult. But I would suggest to you that this idea of surrendering and letting go of the way in which we define the world and we are in the world is really about what we worship. What defines us? And I turn to my colleague Frederick Muir again and his little article about the issue of idolatry to understand this. He's having a conversation about defining everything theologically as a debate between theism and atheism, and he has encountered a professor that is challenging him. And the professor says, or he says, I kept trying to frame the debate as theism versus atheism, and he finally shared that he really didn't think that was it. It was theism versus idolatry, and it was then that he said, we all worship something, we all have our gods. What are yours? He continues, not idolatry, he says, but hope. And Ken Bode comments in the first, you have to row a little boat. When we kill the hope within us, we kill ourselves, even though the blood continues to flow through our veins. We can see the signs of this living death all about us everywhere. In shopping malls, in discounted department stores, we see people scurrying compulsively, buying compulsively, as if they hoped through the expenditure of money, the acquisition of goods, to deaden the pain they don't even know that they have. I know a couple who uses shopping to dispel an unyielding sadness that seems to overwhelm them day by day. Whenever their depression becomes more than they can hear, they buy new furniture for their living room. And it helps for a while. Amen? But in due course, the sadness engulfs them again, and they don't know why. Whether it's shopping or any other of other countless things for us to put our energies and faith into, the distractions and detours are many, the ruts that can fall into are worn deep and wide by history, bitterness, societal approval, as well as ignorance. If we don't see dramatic and daring examples, we might think that the power and reality of hope were impossible, and that idolatry rules the day. So where does the power of hope reside? It doesn't reside there, apparently. So I'm going to find it here in just a second. Is it not? You know who you are. So the fact is that it is here. How many of you read The Nugget this week? A couple of you? So there is this incredible poem by William Larson that bears repeating at this very moment about what does it mean to let go of our stuff and what it might teach us. William Larson writes, "At our house there lives a girl, a dog, and a yard full of newly planted flowers. The dog came free, the girl is priceless, and the flowers cost $300. A cozy scene, but complicated in that I love the girl, and the girl loves the dog, and the dog loves to dig up my flowers. And I do not love the dog. Creating a dilemma in which I, who crave even the illusion of control, am stymied between my need for an orderly completion of my desires and the beam of joyous fire in the eyes of the girl, all of which says more about the complexities of love than the training of neurotic dogs. And I have just discovered, in writing these lines, that the dharma of this dilemma has less to do with my training the dog not to dig my flowers than the dog training me to love the girl." So I want you to reimagine your experience with this dilemma, with letting go of the stuff in your life and of your life. And take William Larson's advice and ask yourself what lesson you really have to learn in relationship to these things and that stuff, whether it is holding you fast to an image of yourself that no longer exists except in here, or whether by grappling with it, you actually open up the possibility that you are learning to do the exact thing that will set you free. And that by doing it, you land on solid ground, or you discover you have wings you never, ever knew you had. And it comes with this deep awareness, this deep sense of hope that we can become more than we are in any given moment. It is why we delve into the rough areas of our existence. It is why we do the work in the world that helps to transform lives. It is why we come together in places like this to discover we are not alone in this venture. But more than anything else, it is an opportunity for us to become more of who we are meant to be. And it is only by letting go, by surrendering, if you will, that is possible.